Welcome. Welcome to this super special episode of Karen's Couch, where we're bringing you all things money. Now, back in May, we introduced you to our favourite super spunky money man, Peter Audette, where we asked him all kinds of questions, but the first one started with, how on earth do we make money? And even bigger, how do we keep it? Now, since then, Pete has gone on to have a huge following on the show. We get messages and emails from all over the world, not only telling us how spunky he is, but also telling us how important and how relevant his information is. So we've decided to share with you a whole bunch of little snippets of clips of the brilliant nuggets of gold that Pete has shared with us since then.
How to be happy with money? Because it's not, no one teaches you that, and it's not self-evident. If it was that easy, we'd all be happy all the time. And and financial distress is one of the leading causes of absenteeism for employees. Money doesn't make you happy. You know, everyone remembers Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Yes.
Food, clothing, shelter, security, and then that sort of self-fulfillment at the top.
Yeah.
When you move from absolutely nothing in a third world country through to having food, clothing, shelter and security, that really does make you happy. And so it's a bit insidious when you come out of university and you haven't got any money and you get your first job and suddenly you go from living on the poverty line to having a great income. You really do feel happier than you did before. But from that point forward, money doesn't make you any happier. Only love and friends and family make you happy. Money just is a means to an end. But the negative is true. If you've got enough of food, clothing, shelter and security and you jeopardise it, it makes you unhappy.
Yeah.
But to make good financial decisions, you need two or three things. You need to have some context. In other words, where am I now and where am I getting to? Where, you know, what's my goal in life? And is buying this new car or spending this extra $400,000 on a renovation or going to Europe and spending 50 grand on a holiday, getting me any closer to my goals or not? And most of the time we don't ask ourselves that question. We just have a look at the bank account, say, hey, we've got 50 grand, there's a holiday for 50, let's go. Mm-hmm. And we'll think about all the other things that life will demand of us when they come up, school fees when they arrive, the retirement as it gets closer becomes more relevant, but in your 40s or your 30s, you don't care so much. So so we make all these decisions out of context. We're all very time poor compared to what we used to be. And I think that's evident in the way that we can remain more connected like this. We don't have to be in the same room together. And so we can get a lot more done in a day. You can, and I often do, answer my last email 3 minutes before I close my eyes when I go to sleep. So we're time poor, we're making decisions out of context. But the third one is the biggest one, which is that we're emotionally attached. Now, if you're good at asking for help, what you'll find is the person that you're asking for help, if it's outside the family unit, isn't emotionally attached. So if you say to me, I want to spend 250 grand on a Mercedes-Benz, I'm not going to be in love with a Mercedes-Benz. You are. And so I've got this unbiased, arm's-length opinion of saying that's ridiculous. But all you're thinking about is what you'll look like in it, where you're going to drive it, how much fun it's going to be. People walk into houses and imagine themselves entertaining in that kitchen. You know, it's so emotional. That and all the things you talked about are emotional. Getting your hair done, buying clothes, buying shoes, traveling, it's all these beautiful emotional payoffs. And so this influence of emotion is such a huge factor for all of us, that without being the sort of person that asks for help, and like I said, most men don't, they make all these decisions for themselves. They're time poor, they possibly aren't setting their context, and they're certainly emotionally attached to the outcomes. And the end result of that is poor decision making. The ingredients for a happy and well-balanced financial life are making sure that you control the things that you can control. So you're in control of how much you earn. And if you don't earn enough, you have to take steps. You have to shift your action to improve your lot. And that's something that a financial advisor can't help you with other than telling you that that's what you've got to go and do. Get more education, you know, work smarter, apply your skills better, change your profession to something that better suits who you are and what you want to do. but you have to make the money. We can't make it for you. But once you're generating a level of wealth, then the decisions and the things that you make, if you do it in a balanced way, so if you sit down and say, here's what we look like today, and here's our things that we have to achieve. We must retire at some stage. It's inevitable.
Yeah.
We must educate our children, and it's a pretty good idea to pay off our house, amongst other things in your life that you want to achieve, and then make every decision in the context of all the things that you want to achieve, making sure that you don't spend more than what you make.
Yeah.
You end up finding that it's the balance of never running out of money that keeps people happy. It doesn't make them happy. It keeps people happy. But if you run out of it, it definitely makes you unhappy. The other part of that that's really important, and you talked about this idea of retirement seems so far away.
Mm.
It's a very, very difficult thing to solve, not having enough money in retirement when you get really close to it.
Yeah.
If you start now when you're 44, and you and I are both 44, if you start when you're 44 and you say, I've got 8 things I need to achieve between now and 60, and that's one of them, and you balance it out so that everything gets a bit of attention, none of them are a drain, and you get to enjoy all the things that you want to. But I can absolutely promise you, from having lots of retirees as clients, those with enough money to live on are happy, and those without money, or those without enough money to satisfy the life that they wanted, which is the most important thing, they're not just unhappy. They are perpetually unhappy. They are obsessed with the fact that they don't have enough. And they are at that time in their lives where there's no reversing. You can't go back to work when you're 73 and start all over again.
Absolutely.
You've got what you got. And the only way to do something about it is at 44, not at 64. So it is really important to grow up a bit with this sort of stuff and say, hey, I'm an adult. At some stage, I've got to take some responsibility.
Mm.
And I think this is, if you want to motivate anyone, this is the greatest word to think about, and that is having dignity. Because if I'm 75 and I'm broke and my children have to take care of me, my dignity is going to get knocked around like no one's business, and I don't want to be that person. And so you need to find your own way of motivating yourself to want to make sure that you have your own dignity and pride and capacity for taking care of yourself all the way through.
Mm.
And if that's the sort of person that you are, you will hate getting there and not having enough. So here's my absolute golden tip for anybody, is every time you see someone with the bigger house or the bigger car and you get jealous and you want to keep up with them and go and buy what they've got, first always think, imagine if they wore their balance sheet on their T-shirt. Imagine if it didn't just say, here's my big house and here's my big car, but it said, here's how much I owe, here's how much my credit card debt is.
Yeah.
Because so often what you see is, I can't believe they went broke. How many times do you hear that? They looked like they were doing so well.
Yeah.
I can't believe they went broke. But it is actually the evidence that you're seeing. Of course they look like they were doing well. They spent so much money.
Mm.
They bought the biggest house. They had the biggest car. They took the overseas trips. They had no contingency plan for anything.
Mm.
They spent it up. Everyone was jealous and wished they were them, and then they're broke. So don't judge the person by what you see. Try and consider how much debt they might be in to achieve the things that they've got, and try and park your jealousy and always make your own decisions in the context of your own family, your own resources, and your objectives and goals, not anyone else's, because they might not have 5 kids that they want to send to private school.
Yeah.
They might not want $150,000 a year in income in retirement.
Yeah.
They might have made completely different decisions to you. Or they might just be bloody irresponsible.
So, Pete, in terms of, for our listeners and our viewers, have you got, like, I guess, 3 key strategies that you could leave us with that could perhaps shift a mindset and have us take more strategic choices when it comes to money?
Yeah. Look, I think by far the most important thing is to breathe. So you've got to make sure that you haven't just got so excited about the stuff and forgot about what's really, really important. I know that's a bit philosophical, but
no,
like you said, you can't take it with you. And And the only things that will really make you happy will be the love and enjoyment of friends and family. Mm. And if you give all of that up to own stuff, it's a huge mistake. So take a breath. That's the rule number one.
Mm, I love that.
Take a breath. Set some context around that before you make a decision. Try and see if you can get someone's opinion who's not emotionally involved is always really good. So get a second opinion. Now, obviously, I'm a financial advisor and I would say see a financial advisor.
Yeah.
But you can really talk to anyone who is somewhat of an expert. But you want to do it in the context of understanding your goals all the time. But try and get someone who's out of the emotion to help you with that. But the other thing that's interesting too for the last sort of rule, so set some context and make a good decision with some help.
Yeah.
But the last one is to actually do things. People's failure to implement can be one of the reasons that they don't do as well because they get a bit organised, but they're so busy that they actually don't go, okay, I need to pay more money into super, I'll get to that. I need to make sure I'm getting the cheapest interest rate, I'll get to that. Make sure your wills and powers of attorney are in place, that your debt structure is right, all these different sorts of things that you can do. But we're so busy that you go, look, I'll get to all of it at some stage, and then you don't get around. So this failure to implement can cost people, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars over their lives. And yet you've gone to the same effort at work every day, whether you were efficient or not. You've got up every morning, you've worked hard all day.
Yeah.
You've enjoyed time with your family, you've done all the right things. But if you don't get organised and implement, you can just be wasting money that otherwise could have helped build your wealth and give you a greater level of comfort at some stage in your life when you need it.
And the question that you guys have posted to us is about investing. When's a good time to get in? When's a good time to get out? And how do we even know what a good investment is? What does that even look like for somebody who possibly has never invested before?
And how you choose something in the first place, I think that's probably the most the most relevant way of doing it. I always like to think about like buying a car. When you go to buy a car, when we went to buy our last car, we looked at things like how many seats there were because we had three babies and we needed three baby seats across the back seat. We needed something that could tow a trailer. We needed a range of things. And so before we went to the car yard, we did some research and decided what we needed the outcome to be. I think a lot of the time when people buy investments, particularly if they buy something from someone that is product-driven in some respect, rather than starting with what they need it to do, it's often what the person who's promoting that particular product needs buy.
They've got a hidden agenda as opposed to focusing on what's important to you. They focus on what's important to them.
Yeah, and look, it's not always a bad thing. You know, the property salesmen sell property. That's what you go to them for. You don't expect anything else. You have to first decide if that's going to suit you or not. And I think if it does, it will become self-evident when you list the things that you need it to do. So if you need cash flow, you don't buy a negative geared investment property because, as it suggests, you're going to be putting money in, not extracting money back out of it. Your time frame for the way that you invest might be shorter. So if you're not in it for the long term, again, using property as a good reference, it's not appropriate. If you're only investing for 18 months, knowing the expense of getting in, the stamp duty, cost of getting in, the exit fee of paying an agent when you get back out the other side of it, it makes it really difficult to justify doing that in a short space of time. Once you've determined what your goals are, what you need the investment to do, it will all make sense. You will know what your time frame capabilities are. So if you don't need the money for 7 years, it can influence the sort of thing that you invest in. But if you need it in 6 months for a deposit on your family home, then it's not going to be appropriate to put it into a speculative mining stock, as an example. So, so once you've figured out what you need it to do, you'll continually narrow the path down. You know, when you're buying the car, the first thing you figure out if you've got more than three kids is that you need a car with more than five seats. So you can start to cancel out all the things that just don't suit you because you know what it is that you need to achieve. And then everything else just becomes fairly simple.
Is there a time where it becomes appropriate to get out of an investment property? Like in our situation, we've still got it. Because I'm thinking if I sell it, chances are the market's going to go up just on the day that I sign the papers. Or I'm thinking, well, you know, it is cyclical. The market is cyclical. What if I just stay in there another couple of years, but it's still costing $20,000 a year?
It's always a really difficult one, and it's very individual, because if it wasn't costing you $20,000 a year, you'd have more time and less sort of negative feeling in there.
Yeah, totally.
My view is the best way to do it is always to look at right here and right now and park the history. So don't think about how much you bought it for. Just have a look at how much debt you've got today,
right,
and what it's worth today. And then on today's market with today's opportunities in other areas, if you were looking at what money you would get when you got out of it, and where you would otherwise deploy that, if you had an alternative opportunity, would you do it?
Absolutely.
So, do you know what I mean? If you look at it and say, if I had my, let's call it $500,000, if I had my $500,000 again today, would I go and buy that same unit? If the answer's no, you've probably just answered that question. But it is, make no mistake, it is one of the most difficult things emotionally to do, because we, as human beings, have a reluctance to experience a sunk cost. We would rather, in most circumstances, emotionally wait for the value of that property to return to what we bought it for, even if that passage of time takes years longer than if you'd have taken it and put it somewhere else.
Yeah.
But we're more inclined to do that than we're inclined to take it on the chin. So you're not Robinson Crusoe as far as that avoidance of that ill feeling. That's really, really normal, but it doesn't make it right.
Do you have a really practical way of calculating how much money we need for our retirement?
The current thinking is to plan around this idea that if you want to preserve capital in retirement, and I think this is the utopia of capital preservation, that you want to think about somewhere between an average rate of return of income after expenses of 3 or 4%. It's very conservative, and it is so on purpose, because if you take life events, long-term averages, you have to take into account market fluctuations and the way that the world moves. That an average compound rate of return is different when you're accumulating money to when you're spending money. Because
what does that mean?
It's like a leaking boat.
There you go.
How's that sound?
That's better language for me.
So when you don't have a leak in the boat, it's pretty easy. It's pretty easy for things to keep going well.
Yeah.
But once the boat starts leaking, then it's always a battle. It's always a battle. And in retirement, that nest egg that you've built up is always leaking. You have to live. You have to spend money.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. When I talk about the compounding return, you have to spend money in the years where you make a good return. You have to spend money in the years when you don't make a good return. And you have to spend money in the years when the market's down and you've lost money. So you have to live all the time. So you need to make sure that you've got a sufficient amount of money put aside that can cope with all those different sorts of scenarios. The best way to do that is to use a very low rule of thumb. So 3 or 4%. So if you want $40,000 a year, save $1 million. Really, really simple. If you want $80,000 a year, save $2 million. On the basis that if you've got something like that, then you should be able to sustain that amount of capital your entire life and achieve that 3 or 4% income.
And just to finish up, when do you think it's wise to start planning for that? Is there a certain point in a person's life at a certain age? I mean, if we're 20, should we be thinking about it? Should I be thinking about it? At what point is best?
Well, I think in the cascading order of life, I think if you're in the mindset of wanting to own your family home, then that's your first priority. Buy it and pay it off.
Yep.
And then from there, work towards making sure that you've got a sustainable level of savings. With maybe one rule, and that is that when you buy your first house or your second house, you should have in mind what retirement needs to look like.
Yeah.
Because if you spend all of your money on today, you'll have nothing for tomorrow. And there would be a long list of people who have retired with a $3 million house and 2 Mercedes Benz and no savings. And it's amazing how the lifestyle changes once the income stops.
What is negative gearing?
It's a good question. It's a great question, actually, because it's a popular thing in the Australian marketplace. Negative gearing is when you borrow to buy an investment. Typically in Australia, we're in love with property, and so people often go and buy an investment property using the bank to fund it, and only putting sometimes a small deposit down, sometimes no deposit at all. They might use the equity in their own home.
Because when you borrow from the bank, and it's an investment property, they let you borrow 90%, or it used to be 95%, still got to pay mortgage insurance and stuff, but the debt on it's really high.
Yeah, if you've got equity in your own home, as an example, often the banks will let you pool all your assets together. And so you might be in a position where you can actually borrow 100% of the value of that house because you've got sufficient equity in your other property.
Right.
The word negative is relating to the idea that that the amount of rent that you collect in the case of an investment property is less than the interest that you're paying the bank all the time. And so people find themselves in a situation where it's essentially leveraging. You're taking the bank's money and you're putting it into the investment market with the hope that the property goes up in value, which is a good thing if the property goes up in value.
And it's a really bad thing if the property doesn't.
Absolutely. And so
here's one we prepared earlier.
The problem, I think the really big problem with it is people's motivation. So often people are motivated towards wanting to buy an investment property for a couple of reasons.
Yeah.
I think we love this idea about being an owner of more than one house, and it's a very physical, tangible sort of thing. But also this tax deduction draws people in. And so what they often fail to do is they fail to look at whether or not it's really appropriate for them. They get very focused on the tax deduction, very focused on this idea of being a multiple property owner.
Yes.
And the idea that if everything works, that it will pay for itself.
Yeah.
To debunk the theory, that doesn't always work. A couple of reasons for that. If you gear 100% of it, the opportunity to try and pay the debt down when you've got so much debt and so much interest cost before you pay any capital off, it's very difficult to do. And so you'll find in a lot of instances people will go for years on end on interest only. Absolutely counting on the growth in the value of that property to deliver all the return.
Yeah.
So not only have they spent all the rent that they got, but they've spent their own hard-earned money. Even with the tax deduction, if you spend a dollar on interest pre-tax, depending on your tax rate, if you'd have even paid tax at the highest marginal rate, you would have otherwise still had 55 cents in your hand at the end.
Right.
So if you go and you spend your $20,000 a year for years and years and years on end and you get no growth, then the outcome is exceptionally poor. And I think people often forget just how much money they've actually laid out to achieve that rate of return. And if it doesn't come, it can be incredibly difficult.
Mm, mm.
That isn't to say it's the wrong thing to do, but it needs to suit your own circumstances because it's not cheap. And it relies completely on the market to deliver a return and not on you as an individual. So if you save your own money, you can be very certain of what you've ended up with. When you negatively gear, you put all of the performance in the hands of the market and you ask the market to deliver you that rate of return. We have no control over it. And here's the one thing to always bear in mind more than anything else. Every major capital city in Australia is considered on world standards to be severely unaffordable. So we have some of the highest property cost in the entire world.
Right.
And that's the starting point in negative gearing into property, at least. That's your starting point. An already very expensive market that's very reliant on all of us still having jobs and all of us having a buoyant economy consistently in order to maintain those property prices.
And I really want to find out from you, Pete, is getting a tax break enough of a reason to go after an investment that could potentially be a noose around my neck?
No.
That was easy.
And that's a wrap. No. It's a really good question. A tax deduction can be a reasonable sort of beneficial side effect of some of the things that you do when you're investing. But it shouldn't usually be your dominant purpose for it. The main reason for that is to get a tax deduction with your $1, you have to spend it. So if you have borrowed to go into the stock market, as an example, you have to buy a dollar's worth of interest and you get a tax deduction. Had you have not bought that dollar's worth of interest, you would have paid tax at your normal marginal rate. So if you're on the 30 cents in the dollar tax bracket, you would have paid 30 cents.
And you still have 70 cents
about
left.
31.5, but they will call it 30 for the purposes of averaging. But
that's
it's about,
such a finance thing to say.
But you still get to you get to keep your 70 cents.
Yeah.
So to get that tax deduction, you have to spend it on something, and the outcome of that something that you spend has to be something positive, because you've given away 30 cents of the tax officer's money, but you've given 70 cents of your money away. There has to be an outcome. It just can't be the tax deduction. So really good example, you borrow $200,000 to go into the share market. You borrow some money off your home and you invest it in the shares. The market will do what the market does over a period of time, and that's the subject of an entirely different 5 minutes.
It's a whole other show.
But what will happen is the bank will charge you, let's call it 6% interest on the $200,000. So it costs you $12,000 a year of your own money to keep that money in the market, and you'll get some dividends that come back to support it on the way through. But you've still got to spend your $12,000. Now, over any sort of period of time, if you don't get an economic benefit greater than what you've spent, it's not a positive outcome. So there has to be a reason for it. And the answer, the real answer to all of this is you don't start with a tax deduction. You start with what it is that you're trying to achieve, and maybe tax comes along the side.
So when it comes to divorce, Pete, I know that this is something that you've got some really amazing information to share with us about today. There are lots of people who are in various stages of divorce, and it is always an ugly experience, or anticipated to be an ugly experience. Start from the beginning. Where does it go wrong? And I don't mean in terms of the relationship, because I think that's another show. Yeah. That's another five shows. But I mean in terms of where does it go wrong for us when we decide that we don't want to be with somebody anymore, or they decide they don't want to be with us? How does it all turn so pear-shaped?
There's so many different angles that you could think about that question in terms of your answer, and I'll try and pick through the main ones that I've seen, because I think that probably makes the most sense. People often when someone separates or is getting divorced, it's a very emotional time.
Very emotional.
And it can be a place where people seek to try and score some points with a hope, I suppose, at times of making themselves feel a bit better.
And especially if somebody's been hurt. I know I've had, divorce rates are fairly prevalent. So I think we all know people who've been divorced if we haven't been divorced ourselves.
Yeah.
I think sometimes if you've been hurt, you can use the divorce as a way to get the person back. You hurt me and I'm going to get you back, and it's going to hit you in the hip pocket.
And money's a great lever for driving discourse between people.
Mm.
You want something, I want something. I'll feel better if I get more than you. I do some work with a family law firm. And we try and intervene quite early and try and get people to take a breath and try and get them to stop and almost like reset the concrete.
Yeah.
Because all that wonderful foundation of life that you've had that possibly you've relied on for 10 years or 20 years or longer.
Yeah.
Is suddenly someone comes in with a jackhammer and digs it all up and says that everything that everything that you had and everything that you relied on suddenly isn't there anymore.
Yeah.
So without that foundation, you've created, instead of, we talked before about that beautiful positive vibe of buying a beautiful house or a beautiful pair of shoes or
it's
something.
It's all about the shoes.
This is all the negative. This is all disturbing and everything's wrong and how am I going to survive? And so you need to bring people back Tony Phillips, who I've done some work with, had given me some great insights into things that he says when he talks to people. He's the family lawyer.
Yeah.
He said to me that he doesn't do castrations and crucifixions.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So if you've come with...
And it feels like that too,
sounds, if you've come with your boxing gloves on, then you're in the wrong place. because his view, which I think was really great, he said, is that it's an opportunity for a new start. And if you start with the first thing that you do is bring people back down and say, this is an opportunity for a new start.
Yeah.
And everything that was there before certainly is whilst it feels chaotic, it's also like hitting the refresh button where you stop and you go, I've got a chance now to choose what the next part of my life looks like. You're in this unique set of circumstances where often you accumulate things over time. Suddenly that's stopped, whether you chose that or not. And that can be a different conversation. But nevertheless, that's where you are. So you need to stop and take a breath and say, what's important to me now?
Yeah.
What's important to me moving forward?
Yeah.
And recategorize the things, the stuff.
Yeah.
In order of what you need today in the new world. So instead of deciding, as many people do, that I have to stay in the family home. This is where I feel safe. This is where I have the most security. I'm not moving. I'm not the one that did the wrong thing.
Yeah.
He or she chose to leave. I'm staying put. No matter what, no one's getting me out of this house. That's such a narrow...
I think everybody must... The story must be the same in most cases because...
It's not the first time you've heard that, is it?
No, I was going to say, I've heard that five or six times with people that I know. I'm not leaving.
But then what you really do need to consider is I'm now on my own, with or without children quite possibly.
Yeah.
What are my new goals and financial objectives? What are my new life goals?
Yeah.
Where do I want my life to be? Where am I going to be? Is my career going to change? Do I need to re-engage with employment if I've been out of the workforce? And does the home that I'm in now, whether it's fair or unfair, is it the right place to be? Can I afford to be there? Is it practical for me to be there? You don't necessarily have to answer that single question. What you really have to do is answer all the questions. Here I am today. Here are my new set of potential resources at my disposal in the matrimonial pool.
Mm.
And here's what I want to achieve over a period of time. What do I need?
Yeah.
Don't just take what you think will
hurt the other person. Yeah. Or
stop and think about where I will be. And I think if you do that, then what starts to happen, again, in my view, having seen this a few times, is you get to dictate bringing some logic back into the conversation.
Yeah.
And there's nothing like calming the conversation down. I'll keep using Tony as a great example, but he said to me, and it makes so much sense in the way he said it, he said, it's very, very hard once you've put the war paint on to take it off. And sometimes the greatest thing to do is not very much for the first 12 months.
Just
take a breath and say, let's let the dust settle and just work through where we want to be.
God, that would just be an amazing conversation to be able to have with somebody that, you know, and I always think of it, if you've been married to somebody, you married them for a reason. You did love them and you did love each other and you were together for a reason. And just because the circumstances may have changed or something's changed in the relationship doesn't make one or the other a bad person, therefore needing to be punished. And I think taking that time, and if it is 12 months or 6 months or whatever it is, to take that time and say, well, what do we both want to get out of this? Because prior to the divorce or prior to the separation, you probably would have had that conversation with each other because the lines of communication were open. But after the separation, there just seems to be this mindset shift in that you need to pay.
All the things that we planned to do, the time frames that we planned around when we were going to make decisions, those milestones have arrived. And we're having these meetings saying, right, here we are. And it's time to buy that house. Let's go shopping. She had some health concerns and wasn't able to drive for a period of time. And she's got back on her feet in terms of her great state of health that she's in. And she's got a car and her independence again. And so you get through the other side of this process and you see someone who's stopped and decided that they would take some advice but make some really sensible decisions for them, not for anyone else, but for them.
Yeah,
and sometimes you need you need someone standing beside you saying it's okay to look after you.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you've got children and the dissolution of a marriage, this whole emotion about guilt, about leaving the family home or letting the children down, or
yeah.
you know, we take a lot of responsibility for our own behaviour a lot of the time in our lives. And I think that it's okay at times to remind people that part of this process is, just like you always say, it's about being okay about yourself, at deciding what's important for you and making great considered decisions about what you get to control where your life is going to be. And once you decide to do it that way, and I think you can even sense it in as we talk about it,
yeah.
all the chaos disappears.
Absolutely. I'm feeling incredibly calm about a fairly tumultuous topic.
I've met a lot of family lawyers, and I think you would be quite surprised to realise just how many of them would rather see a separation and a divorce run smoothly.
Yeah.
I don't think any of them really, I don't think many of them set out to get you in court and yeah. fight. I really yeah. don't. I really yeah. think that the great ones that I've met
yeah.
really care about the people and about getting a fair result for them and helping them through that negotiation process. And my experience has been, more often than not, it's not the lawyers that create the chaos.
Who is it?
It's mum and dad rolling their sleeves up and going
for it. Right, you are. Today we're going to be talking about self-managed super funds. Try it. That's a tongue twister. You know, everybody's talking about it and how you can buy property with your super. I didn't even know that that was possible. I didn't think that was legal. How come everybody's talking about it? What have I missed?
There was a change in legislation over recent years that has allowed people to be able to, through a trust, be able to borrow money to buy property in superannuation. So we'd all be fairly familiar with negative gearing into investment properties by borrowing using the bank.
Yep.
Super funds have not usually been able to borrow money.
I thought that's what that was the rules in a super fund.
Yeah. So there was a change in the legislation that has opened up this window where people are able to set up a trust and use some money from the super fund together with borrowing money from the bank and go out and buy investment properties. My understanding at the moment is that it's the single most popular thing that's being talked about in the financial services industry. Yeah. From the consumer's perspective. So there's a lot of consumer-driven interest in it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the perpetual Australian love affair with investment properties.
Yeah.
And so many people have not been in a position where they've been able to have a deposit to go and buy an investment property.
And your superannuation seems like a really yeah. great place to go.
Everyone's got compulsory superannuation.
Absolutely. Yeah.
My concern... and it's not to do with property itself, and I want to make that clear. This isn't there's no property bashing going on. My concern is it's a great opportunity from a sales perspective. If you are a property development business
right.
or a property company, there are some that are around that are in a position where they're marketing directly to people to get them to use self-managed superannuation as a means of buying properties. So they've found an angle where they can find people who may not otherwise be able to afford to do it, who've got savings in superannuation, and they can get them into a position where they can buy an investment property. And as always, and I think every time you and I talk about these things, we always start with the same thing,
yeah.
is that if someone walks in and starts with the product, you should leave the room. That you have to have a strategy and a structure. You have to know what it is that you're trying to achieve before you make any investment decisions.
Mm.
And my greatest concern is that a lot of people are starting with the property purchase decision and trying to make everything else fit around it. And they're not necessarily looking at whether or not it's right for them,
yeah.
whether or not they're creating a lack of diversification amongst the different investment assets that they've got, whether or not there's enough revenue in their superannuation from their employment to pay the debt down in an appropriate fashion, whether they're over-leveraging, and the list goes on and on and on. Yeah, because you might even find, and you often do find, that The investment property idea may be a wonderful idea for that particular person, but it may be far more beneficial for it to not be in the super fund. So the idea now that we can use these self-managed super funds to buy property, I think it just adds another option to your planning. Mm. And again, it shouldn't be the thing you start with. It should just be one of the things in your toolbox,
yeah.
in the arsenal of things that you can do, where you go, I know the things I need to achieve. I know the resources that I've got to achieve them so that I can retire comfortably. Now let's make a balanced decision about where these things should be and how they fit me and my life, not just... And I suppose to think about the worst case scenario is just going to a seminar where they stand up and sell the property because they don't care who you are...
Absolutely.
..or what you have or what your goals are. And it's not a bad thing that they don't care. I think they're very transparent and they're saying, if you come to our seminar, we're here to sell your property in a self-managed super fund. Let
yep.
the buyer beware.
Yep.
It's your idea to go along. So,
yep.
so I'm not suggesting that there's anything nefarious about it. But that's not the kind of environment where they're going to ask you if it fits you.
Yeah.
They're going to try and make it fit you, and that's not sensible.
So you want to know before you go to a seminar like that, not during that seminar.
Yeah.
How we can start to teach our kids to manage money effectively. And who better to take us down that rabbit hole than Peter Audette, who's our resident money man, but he's also the expert on all things money, savings, debt, investments, all that sort of stuff.
I think it's really, it's very difficult to do. And I don't know that I've got all the perfect answers. Some of it's parental and some of it is from experience.
Do you spoil your kids rotten?
Terribly, terribly. And look, I think we all do.
Everybody does.
One of the problems that we have as a generation is that we're growing up where houses are very expensive. And as a result of that, we're exposed to living beyond our means often. So we often have to dig deep to buy a home. We often have to have periods when we're in debt if we want to take a holiday or we want to do things because so much of our lives are committed to buying a family home. And so when it comes to setting an example for your children, we're not a great example as a society because it's tough. It's tough to make enough money to make ends meet as it is, let alone to take the time to take a breath and try and tell your children not to do what they're seeing, but to do something else.
How do we get our kids younger so that they don't get to the age of 19 and be at a point where they're spending every cent?
I think a really good idea is to do simple goal setting. So rather than getting too complex with it about very long goals because children are young and emotional, and often quite materialistic, rather than fighting the tide, which you'll never do.
Yeah.
Work with it. Set them a goal about something really simple. I want a surfboard. It's $400. It's going to take you 4 months to save up for it. Work with them to save the $400 up. Buy the surfboard. Set the goal. Get the reward. Build the muscles around goal setting and reward for the effort of not just spending all the money on the movies or television or whatever it might be that they're going to do in very short, simple terms. Get them to set a reasonable medium-term goal. And medium-term for children is 3 or 4 months. In fact, that's probably a lifetime for them.
Yeah, I was going to say 3 or 4 days. Yeah,
but give them something where they can go, okay, I cast my mind forward to something I wanted. I put my mind to it and I got rewarded for it. And then as you get older, the goals are going to be bigger and longer. But the routine's there.
Yeah.
Without that routine, people just get whatever it is that they have, just like Liam did, and spend every cent until there was nothing left. And that's that we perpetuate that well into our 20s, 30s. Some people just never stop doing it. So I think that's an excellent way of starting.
So not only has Pete become an incredible asset to the Karen's Couch family, but he's also become a really cool friend. Now, he provides us with lots of advice around our financial freedom and how to manage our money, not only just for me, but for all of our team. So he's become somebody that's really integral in figuring out how we can start to live a much more exciting and free life when it comes to the cash flow. So hold on, sit tight, because we've got Pete coming up on Karen's Corner right up next. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome. Welcome here to Karen's Corner, where we've got another special edition of Karen's Corner with our gorgeous money man, Peter Audette. Look at him. Isn't he fabulous?
Hey?
You know, I'm getting... I actually got a message from one of you girls telling me how fabulous he was. You're getting a bit of a fan base, Tiger.
Thank you.
We're only human, aren't we?
Getting very embarrassed at the same time. Thanks very much.
I thought that was the light.
I think I'm going red.
So speaking of your feedback and your emails that have come in, we've had a really important question that I thought was terrific to be able to pose for you today, which is about how do we manage a household that is already in debt? You know, if you think about it, we've got Generation Y kids that are quite expensive and they stay at home a lot longer and they keep a strain on the family budget for a lot longer than what Generation X did. So our parents, the parents of the Generation Y, they love to be able to give to the kids and to, you know, give them everything that they possibly can, which then can sometimes leave the family budget running far behind. So, Pete, I think today's conversation has got to be around what are some of the steps, what are some of the strategies that these families can engage to get themselves back in front? You know, the question that I've had is that they're living beyond their means and their credit card is really what gets the family through each week and each month, but then that takes all of the income just to repay the debt.
Yeah.
How does a family get out of that cycle that, you know, would have them gripped by the throat? Because from a parent's perspective, it'd be hard to breathe underneath that weight.
Yeah, I agree. I think if we start with the real practicalities, and I think this is important, if someone came to see me for advice, that the first thing we would do is say, what's the sum of your life till today? What do you own? What do you owe? How much, you know, what are your resources? What do you earn? And what are you spending?
Yeah.
Very much like going to the doctor and saying, right, the first thing I need to understand is what are all the symptoms? Before we start to figure out what's wrong, what's actually wrong, just what are we experiencing? How much money have we got? What assets have we got? What are we trying to deal with now? Tell me. First of all, before you tell me about your goals, tell me what your problems are, what's happening. The really interesting part about all of this is that it's a very adult conversation, because part of what might transpire out of that is not just that you're finding it difficult, but there are things that you can no longer have. And I think what we've got at the moment is the capacity with credit to have everything that we want and then complain about how difficult it is to make ends meet having everything. Whereas the one thing that you're missing out on is the comfort of not being overextended. Mm. And that itself is a thing, and that's a great thing. Feeling like you can pay all your bills and there's something left and you're saving and moving forward. That's better than a jet ski, I've got to say. You know what I mean? And so it's not a materialistic thing. But we've taken that off the table. Mm. We keep spending all our money going, man, we've got all this stuff. And then at the end of every month sitting around going, I've got all this stuff. How come I feel so bad about it?
Yeah.
And it's because we're not counting the financial independence of having some surplus as a thing that we should be really happy about.
So what are some of the steps, short and sweet, that a family can do to get themselves in front when they've been behind all along because they didn't get educated when they were younger? They never learnt how to manage their money. What are some of the steps that they can take to get in front? And it feels like that might be a bit of a pinch initially. What do you think?
I think the first thing to do is understand where everything's going.
Yeah.
Probably take some advice on the structure of the way you're doing things to see if there are some efficiencies that can be gained in some tax planning or some restructuring of your debt so that you get the most out of what you currently have. So first of all, take it from a sort of a global perspective and say, well, there might be some efficiencies we can find. Before we just stop going to the movies, let's make sure that we're not paying too much for things that we could otherwise have at a better price. And then from there, start to break down between things that are necessary and things that are optional. And I think make a few hard choices and decide that you can't have everything.
So make a budget?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Go through your credit card statement and just look where it's going.
Yeah, right.
Because I think that's a big one, especially with PayPass now. It's so easy. You don't even feel like you're pulling it out of your wallet. But it's a great record because you can see all the things that you're spending, itemized, when you did it, how much you spent.
It's a great way of sitting down and going, wow, did you realise we're spending $280 a month on takeaway coffee?
I remember many moons ago, a woman gave me the same advice, but I went and sought advice because if we know better, of course we're going to do better. So we've got to come and see somebody who's got the answers and has been thinking about this as an expert. And she said to me, get your credit card statement, get a green highlighter and a blue highlighter. And she said, highlight everything that's necessary and everything that's optional. And when I calculated everything that was optional, I actually got perspective. And that was life-changing for me. Yeah. So creating a budget is one thing. What about, you know, we want to give our kids everything, and sometimes that's really expensive. Do you think there's value in actually involving the whole family in that budgeting process so that the kids know that things are going to be a little bit tight for a while and then they learn to...
Yeah. When I was in my early teens, my father lost his job, and we lived in a small country town where he never really worked again, not really at the capacity that he'd worked up until that time. And he lost his job when he was 42. So he was at a point where we'd have otherwise thought that was the prime income-earning years of his life. Suddenly he didn't have a job. And I remember we had a family meeting and Mum sat down and said, the world's about to change.
Mm.
And we had that meeting without my father there to support him, to say, things are going to be different and you're going to have to, as a family, understand what the limitations are. I think that a lot of people don't realise that's a gift. That all the time, and look, I'm guilty of it as much as everyone else who's saved. I'm sort of preaching and throwing eggs at myself at the same time. I've got children, I want to buy them everything all the time, and you love it. We love giving gifts, and the more successful you become and the more capacity you have, the more things that you want to do for people, and that's a beautiful, beautiful thing. But you have to sometimes remember that not doing it is a gift. Giving them the capacity to get it for themselves, to let them tie their own shoelaces, to let them write their own things down instead of always giving them the answer. Give them something to work towards and start to consciously realise that not giving them everything is the gift of building some ambition for them. I think that's incredibly important.
And perhaps giving them different things to focus on. So let's recap what we've just covered here, because we want to keep it nice and short and sharp so that you can just pick it up and run with it. So the first thing is create a budget for your family and involve everybody in it, to then understand that there are some things that you can't afford. And I think possibly too, to give your kids different perspective of what's valuable. So if in the past an iPad was valuable to them, teach them the value of building their own go-kart. You know, there's other ways that you can get kids to get excited about their lives. So build a budget, involve the whole family, and also get some outside perspective. I think that's really, really important, because if you could have fixed it, you would have done it by now.
And I think the really, just to finish on that point, the really important part about seeking help from the outside is not that a good financial advisor knows all the answers. It's that a good financial advisor knows all the questions. That's the most important thing. It's about trying to find out what's more important to you, what you want to achieve, and what things you are or aren't currently comfortable with, and then working with you to solve those problems. I think it'd be naive to think we had all the answers, but I think we've become very good at asking, finding out what's really important for you so that we can get you to bring it to top of mind and focus on that so that you're happier with the money that you've got and you create less strain for yourself.
Yeah.
Probably by being at times less materialistic or less wanting and creating some space. I think that's really important.
And I think kids learn from that. I think we all learn from that. And we don't want to be teaching our kids the lesson of stress and strain because of money in our relationships too.
Correct.
And that's a byproduct of keeping ourselves in debt and constantly being in catch-up with our credit cards and loans. So hopefully this segment has been helpful for you. Hopefully it gives you something that you can work with your kids and inside of your families. Check your credit cards, get the green and yellow highlighters, and you'll be surprised. Join us here next week on Karen's Couch. Make sure that you go to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, go to the Facebook page at allthews.facebook.com/Karen's Couch. Make sure that you post your comments on today's episode, and we'll look so forward to hearing from you. Send your emails and your questions through, and Pete the Money Man will be right back with us on another episode. Thanks a bunch. We'll see you right here next week on Karen's Couch.